This week on Pop of Culture.
Talent is really everywhere. That a lot of people are talented. They just need a space to do it. You know, and we have that.
An interview from downtown.
I have built relationships with some really wonderful theaters. I've had my plays produced at some wonderful theaters. I have had my work produced consistently. I work consistently. And for me, that feels like success.
We talked to a playwright who moved from New York City to the top of a mountain. Coming up from IPR.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, the IAC's Arts Partner for East Central Indiana, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency, and by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
From Indiana Public Radio, this is Pop of Culture. Today, we listen back to a conversation my co-host Jen Blackmer had with an artist who moved from New York City to Tennessee. Jen has been seeking out artists who choose to live and work outside of major coastal cities. Some of these artists started out in places like New York or Los Angeles, but the journey led them to create art elsewhere.
Elizabeth Gregory Wilder is a playwright, and her numerous plays include Fresh Kills, The Flagmaker of Market Street, The Furniture of Home, White Lightning, and others, and they've been produced at the Royal Court in London, Alabama Shakespeare Festival, Denver Center, Cleveland Playhouse, Kansas City Rep, Northlight, and many, many others. Her plays have been produced everywhere, but she chooses to make her home in Tennessee, where she is the assistant professor of creative writing at Suwannee, the University of the South. I spoke with Elizabeth about her career and why she chooses to make a home on the top of a mountain. Can you describe Suwannee a little bit for our audience in case they're not familiar?
So Suwannee, Tennessee is this little hamlet on top of a mountain, actually technically the Cumberland Plateau, in between Chattanooga and Nashville in Tennessee. When you drive into Suwannee, you go through these gates, these big stone gates, and there's a sign that says you are now entering the domain. So it feels a little bit like you're entering some sort of cult, and sometimes it feels a little bit like a cult. But it is really just one of the most tranquil, peaceful places you can ever imagine. The domain, which is what it is referred to, is actually owned by the diocese, the Episcopal Diocese. And so it's protected land. We have these wonderful hiking trails. The university itself is modeled after Cambridge. And so everything here is built out of stone. And so the buildings just, it looks like something you would see in an old New England campus.
Sure.
So they call it the Hogwarts of the South, if that,
of course.
If that helps you envision it. And one of the things that's very unique about Suwannee is that we all wear teaching gowns. So
yes, I've seen photos.
So when I teach, I wear a gown, and the students wear gowns to class. So they earn their gowns based on their academic achievements. And so that's a big part of our tradition here. And there's something that I really love about that, because I think tradition is, there's something very theatrical about tradition. Theater is a ritual, and church is a ritual. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at how those two things intersect, you see that there are a lot of similarities there.
Yeah.
So the pageantry of some of our ceremonies here on campus feel very theatrical to me. So even if you're not someone who's particularly religious, I think that, I find a lot of comfort in the predictability of those rituals.
I love that you say that, because when I often tell the story about how I got involved in theater, it was through church. I grew up in a tradition that had a lot of rituals around, you know, Easter and Christmas, and it just, the performativity and the meaning that those events had were really what drew me into theater as an art form. Did you move to Tennessee for the position, for the job you currently have?
Yes, yes. That's what brought me here. I certainly wouldn't have thought 15 years ago that I would be living on top of a mountain in Tennessee. But you know, sometimes we end up right where we're supposed to be. And you know, I'm very grateful to be here. It's been a wonderful place actually to be a writer and to be a parent. It has given me the freedom to be the writer that I want to be, while also giving me the freedom to be the parent that I want to be. And I think that is a really hard balance to find in our business.
Absolutely. And I'd like to explore that a little bit more. So when you lived in New York, you lived there for 11 years. What was it like? If you were to describe that experience, that chapter of your life, to somebody who's never been there before, never spent an extensive amount of time in New York, how would you describe that to them?
So I'm originally from Mobile, Alabama, right down on the Gulf Coast. I actually lived on a houseboat on Dog River, right off the Gulf of Mexico, until I was about 7 years old. I feel like being Southern really shaped my identity as a writer and as a storyteller, even if I think most of what I write these days isn't necessarily rooted in the Southern experience. You know, sometimes I revisit those stories, but not all of my work is Southern. But I moved to New York about a month before my 17th birthday. So I had a really interesting introduction to New York because when I first moved to New York, I was only supposed to go for the summer. My mother later told me that she knew I would never come home. When she put me on the plane, mothers know these things sometimes. But I was taken under the wing of a guy named Roger McFarlane, who was the executive director at Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS at the time. And he took me everywhere. I was 16 turning 17, and he was taking me to Broadway openings and weekends in the Hamptons, and he introduced me to Larry Kramer, who gave me the best writing advice I'd ever been given, which was, writing is like throwing up. You've got to get it all out and clean it up later. It was just sort of a magical experience. So I had graduated from high school a year early. And so I took what would have been my senior year of high school. And I worked at the Theater Development Fund during the day, and I ushered for Broadway shows at night and on the weekends. And it was just sort of everything that like a nerdy theater kid could possibly want. It was just magical. I got an agent because I went there to be an actor. I was auditioning for things. I got a show. I got my equity card. I thought, this is going to be easy, right?
You did all of it, didn't you?
I did all the things. I've literally never used my equity card again after that show. I went there to be an actor. I think I realized very quickly that I wanted to be an actor more than I wanted to do the work necessary to be a good actor. And that's probably a realization that more people need to have earlier in their lives and in their careers.
Absolutely. For me, that was my first semester freshman year of college, actually. So, yes.
Yeah. But, you know, the other thing that happened that year was I got two free tickets to the Young Playwrights Festival at the Public Theater. And I went to see the show, and I remember Madeline George had a play in that festival. You know, and here's this kid who was like a year older than I was, who had this play. And I remember thinking, like, this is a play that like I could have written. Like, these are stories I could have told. And I think up until that point, all the plays that I had ever read mostly were the plays that were in the Mobile Public Library, which sure. meant I thought that those were the people who could be playwrights. And suddenly I saw people who were my age and women who were writing plays. And Wendy Wasserstein happened to be there that day for something. And I went up to her afterward, and I sort of like spewed forth all of this like 17-year-old enthusiasm. And she just looked at me and she took my hand and she said, "You should go home and write a play." And I thought, well, Wendy Wasserstein told me I should write a play, so I should probably do that. But I didn't know how to write a play, so I bought a copy of The Sisters Rosenzweig, and I started writing a play, and I didn't know anything about the structure. So I basically just followed the structure of that play.
Sure, yeah.
And that's how I wrote my first play. So that was just a really – and then I was just hooked, and I submitted this play to a play festival in New York, and it got selected, and suddenly I had, you know, a Tony nominated actor who I had seen on Broadway doing a reading of my play, and I was like, this is awesome.
Wow.
And if the first time the audience laughed at something I wrote, I just, you know, I was done. I was in it to win it.
Yep.
And then I got a letter from my mother that said, enroll in college or come home. So that's what I did. So I went to Purchase College and I got a degree in women's studies and economics. But I took my first playwriting class there with Jeffrey Sweet. And I stayed in New York and commuted back and forth. And Jeffrey Sweet and I would ride the train back to New York together. And so I got sort of like a master class on the ride back with him every week after class. And so I've been writing plays ever since. So I went to school and was writing plays and got my first little production in New York, a little Equity Showcase Theater, right after I graduated from undergrad. And I started applying for different summer programs, which is how I got introduced to SWANI. I did the SWANI Writers Conference twice.
I see.
And because I did the SWANI Writers Conference, someone here introduced me to the Ensemble Studio Theater, where I got into Youngblood, which is their incubator for writers under 30. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was there with Amy Fox and Jay Holtham and Lloyd Saw, and just, you know, this just amazing community of young writers, you know, and we were putting on shows on the weekends and all working, you know, terrible day jobs. And,
sure.
And it was just,
yeah. And you're describing, Elizabeth, this story is so similar to other stories I've heard in terms of how your network begins to form and then blossom. So I'm going to ask you a difficult question.
Yes.
Could you have done any of that or come to the place that you are in your life right now without having thrown it all into the pot and just moved to New York?
You know, that is a really good question. I think everyone really has their own journey. I have no regrets about my time spent in New York. I think I realized fairly quickly that I was not necessarily a New York writer. And it took me a while to kind of figure that out. And I think part of it was, you know, I started getting work produced outside of New York, and I was having more success getting work produced outside of New York. When I left New York, I actually left New York to go work in television, mm-hmm. Which was a whole other experience. But, you know, I do think that there is a way to have a career and to build a career without necessarily starting in New York or LA or Chicago. I think the things that I learned by being a part of those communities was incredibly invaluable. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like there are cities outside of those three cities, mm-hmm. that have cultivated a theater culture that if you are able and willing to invest in those communities, you can create the same experiences there. You know, this summer I went to Atlanta for a long weekend and saw three shows in 2 days and amazing theater.
It's excellent theater down there in Atlanta. It really is.
Yeah, you know, Atlanta has great theater, St. Louis, Austin, you know, there are all of these other places where we're seeing really good theater being made. You know, so much of what we talk about when we talk about the business of the theater is how do we make a living in the theater? And, you know, it is hard to find professional work and ways to support yourself as a playwright or an actor in some of these smaller markets, but I feel like it's all still relative, right? You know, mm-hmm. the smaller markets also have lower costs of living.
Smaller communities, you know, smaller audiences,
smaller communities. Yeah. Yeah. So you're going to have that other job more than likely. Mm-hmm. But here's the other thing. And this is what I also learned about the joys of regional theater. You know, I've had plays done in New York, or like I had a show done in San Francisco that did very well critically. But, you know, I can have a show done in a smaller theater in a bigger city and maybe make $1,000 or $2,000 off of it. Or I can have a play done at a major regional theater and have many more people see it and get a check for $20,000 or $40,000. You know, and so financially, a lot of times building a career in regional theater can actually be more financially profitable.
Sure, sure. And it's the old adage of, do you want to be a big fish in a small pond or a small fish in a massive pond? And I think that one of the things that struck me as I was listening to your amazing story about how you've built your career is this sense of hindsight. Because I do the same thing as I look back on the plays I've written, where they've been produced, the successes and all of that, is that everybody does have their own journey. And I think there's some definite advantages to working in a number of different communities, a number of different types of places. You know, New York is not Indianapolis, is not San Francisco, and they all have their own unique audiences and community projects and things like that. So what I find really exciting, I think, about where we are right now is that communities are able to connect with each other through some of the technology that we have. You can kind of live anywhere and have plays done in other places you've never been. And I think that's an interesting dynamic that probably didn't even exist when we were both starting out, right? That you had to know people who then knew people who would hand your play to somebody and it would get produced, you know, two blocks over. So I think the world is very different than when you and I were both sort of first starting out.
Oh yeah, you know, and the way people network, like just things like the National New Play Network and being able to, you know, put scripts up there. I mean, I've gotten productions because someone read a script that I posted.
Right.
Sometimes it feels like you're just submitting things out into a void. But, you know, I'm always telling my students once they start submitting their work, like so much of it is also just a numbers game.
Right.
And you just have to keep putting it out there. I mean, you know, I remember when I was first starting out, it was expensive to submit your work because you had to mail a hard copy.
Sometimes multiple hard copies.
Yes, yeah. So then you're printing, you know, you're printing your scripts and then you have to put it in a priority mail envelope and you've got to pay the $4 postage, which, you know, back when it was only $4 and, you know, but that was one of the things I loved about doing temp work is like every time I had a temp gig, I would go like run multiple copies of my scripts on their copy machines because I couldn't afford to, you know, go to, you know, Kinko's and have my stuff printed.
Yeah, hopefully the places you worked for aren't listening. But that's it was many years ago, so I'm sure it's fine.
I like to think of it as corporate support of the arts.
There you know? Go. That's amazing. Yes. I love
and
that.
And it's just so much easier to get your work out there now. And, you know, the other thing that whether you're an artist or not, that we all have to keep in mind is I think we all have our own definition of success. And for some people, that's going to be like, I have to have that show in New York. I have to have a show on Broadway or I have to have a show at Playwrights Horizons. And like, we would all love to have that, obviously. But I think I got to a place in my life where I was able to sort of step back and go, you know, I have built relationships with some really wonderful theaters. I've had my plays produced at some wonderful theaters. I have had my work produced consistently. I work consistently. And for me, that feels like success. And, you know, and I'm able to be a parent and I'm able to own a house and I have a retirement plan, you know, all of these things that as you get older, you know, and your priorities shift. So I think that that's a big reason why we're seeing more and more kids stay, or young artists, I don't want to call them kids, staying in their communities or going to these other regional communities and investing in those communities where it is a little more manageable financially to have the career that you want and also be able to, you know, afford to survive.
I find that my goal, I think, is as an educator and as a, I'll just say, older member of the theater community, is to assure younger artists that I know that it is okay. You know, it's okay to set up shop in Indianapolis or Nashville or Minneapolis or Atlanta, which are, you know, these communities, I think, are really exploding with some amazing work. And so my hope is, as we continue to figure out the role that the arts play in our societies as they evolve and change, that these communities will become even more and more, you know, to use the term, legitimate as places to begin a career and to build a career. So I'm very hopeful. I think that, you know, the journey that you went on and that I went on is certainly important and got us to the places that we are right now as artists. And I don't think those journeys need to be duplicated.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, and I love that I've had all of those experiences. And the thing is by having all of those experiences, especially now that I'm teaching, I'm able to bring those experiences and those relationships that I've built into the classroom. And that only helps my students. You know, and the industry has changed a lot. And I do work really hard to try to continue to maintain and to build new relationships so that I know what's going on in the industry so that as I prepare my students to go out into the world, they know what to expect as well.
That becomes a responsibility, I think, for all of us to determine and perhaps even redefine what makes a piece of art, whether that's a play or a piece of fine art or a sculpture or music, what we think of as legitimate and good and moving and powerful, and that the success that an artist has in Muncie or Suwannee, or you know, that this success is a true and valid success.
Definitely. I agree completely.
That was our conversation with playwright Elizabeth Gregory Wilder. This is Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Kara Duquette. IPR's Phil Hoffman has been speaking with arts leaders at institutions across Muncie. This week, he brings us an interview from downtown.
We're joined today by Laura Williamson, who is the Executive Artistic Director at the Muncie Civic Theater. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk a little bit about the Civic Theater's mission. You have a kind of a unique way of being in the theater world. So can you talk a little bit about what the Civic is all about?
Sure. Our mission is to be the theater for the whole community and to enrich our community through theater performance, education, and outreach. So any program that we do, we hold it up to those three ideas. You know, is it a high quality performance? Is it educational? Or is it an outreach program? So which, you know, could be any one of our programs could fall under one of those three.
And you certainly have. I mean, as I pulled in today, there's a school bus out front. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of activity, and it's sure. early morning, which right. you don't think of a theater being busy early in the morning.
Well, you know.
Right. Talk a little bit about sort of like the parts of the theater building and mm-hmm. what you do in those different parts and kind of how people might be experiencing the kinds of programs you offer.
So we have six big main stage shows a year. That's kind of the point of entry that, you know, I think people identify with Civic. A lot of people who have been in Muncie for a long time call it the Civic. And that's always a cue that someone has, you know, been here in the past. We refer to the building now as the Boyce Block. Ever since our renovations, we've really learned how to tell our story. And with the lens of historic preservation, this is Muncie's oldest building. One of the nice aspects of the history of this building is that James Boyce, who built the building, invited the Ball family to come to Muncie and sent them a telegram, because it was heard, it was knowledge that Frank Ball was seeking land in Ohio to rebuild a factory that had burned in upstate New York. So James Boyce made contact, he came, and this was just after the gas boom, and in the 1870s, in the 1880s, and the building was built in 1880. And so James Boyce and a group of other business people said, if you'll build your factory here, we'll give you 5 acres, a gas well, and some money on the side. And we all know how that turned out.
Absolutely.
So, and the room that we are in right now is where they signed that contract.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So we are in the Black Box Theater. Yes. So, of course, mm-hmm. if you've been to the Civic before, you know there's the main stage theater, uh-huh. and then there's the Black Box Theater. Can you explain a little about how the programs presented might differ between those two locations?
Sure. So on our main stage, which is, so as I mentioned, the building was built and it was a general store. And then in 1906, also back to James Boyce, he said, you know, people in Muncie really need something to do. And it's a fact. Yeah. It was then as it is now. And he sold it to a man named C.R. Andrews, who converted a third of the building into the Vaudeville Theater, which was the Star Vaudeville Theater. So then, and then eventually the other two sections of the building became apartments. So people, it was the Star Vaudeville, then it was a movie house, it was the Hoosier, and then Muncie Civic has been there since 1961. And so we have the main stage shows, and that space seats 395. But then the space that we're in right now, the Casazza Family Studio Theater, is a black box theater. We can seat up to 100, but that would be with a very small playing space. 75 to 80 to 95 is our kind of average in this space. And so the seats are, you know, just, you could, you know, very close. And so there's a little bit more emphasis on acting, and you're very close to the audience, the set, everything is very close. It's just a different experience than a more heavily produced show on the main stage, where there's a little bit more focus on lighting, and a lot of the musicals are there. So there's a larger budget for that, just because the shows themselves are larger.
Sure.
And so we never want there to say, well, this is our small budget theater. It's just that the shows are smaller, but of equal quality. And sometimes we really try to keep family friendly as a goal. And we might step outside of that parameter for one show out of our six, kind of call it our date night show. But up here in our black box space, we are able to have a little more leeway to talk about edgier and more just complicated issues. You know, that idea that theater can be here to make people think about something, and not just entertainment and escapism.
Now, one of the things, as you talk about the main stage, that I've been fortunate enough to come and see several shows here at the Civic, that 395 seating capacity, at least in my experience, is almost always completely full. Oh. And in this day and age, yeah, where people don't as much go out to anything, hmm, at all. Mm-hmm. There's so much, you know, Netflix and
sure,
cocooning,
yes,
things.
Yes.
What do you attribute that success to? Because you are often have a packed house. And as you said, it's generally, in my experience anyway, families, mm-hmm, right? It's a whole bunch of kids and their,
sure,
parents.
Sure. Well, something that I think is really lovely about community theater is that it is by the community for the community. So that aspect of supporting each other, of even the people behind the scenes, the people, the numbers of people that it takes to produce a show in terms of building the set, building the costumes, the ensemble, and then there's the running of the show, the people that are the stagehands. Oftentimes, it could be up to 75 people just, in that might, that would include a cast, 75 people producing the show. And so then when you're connected to one of those people and you want to support your family member, friend, or neighbor, then that's our audience. So it's really lovely. I think that whenever I talk to kids, I gave a tour this morning of the building and told the story of, you know, the Ball family and James Boyce. And, you know, their eyes are just like, it's their connection. It's a very personal connection to history. And I say, have you ever seen a show, or do you ever know someone that's in a show? And the hands go up, and which is really lovely. But that gives them the idea that that could be me up there, you know? And I love that. I've always carried the idea that talent is really everywhere, that a lot of people are talented. They just need a space to do it, you know, and we have that. And so we need people with talent, you know, and we have the time to coax that out of people and to build that confidence, because that's really what it takes, is just the confidence to step up. You know, it's just, yeah, it's easy. You're right. It's easier to just watch TV or watch somebody else do this. But then where is that moment? Where is that little voice that says, I could do that? And you know what ends up happening is that they make friends. I thought that a really good slogan would be, we should forget the dating apps, come and be in a play. People meet people.
That's a different way to market it.
It's a different way to market it. I know, like Valentine's Day, you know. No, but we've had, I was just sharing a story with you earlier about special friends that they get married here on the stage because this is a really sacred space for them because of the people that have changed their lives.
Now, speaking of sacred dates, mm-hmm. coming up very soon.
Yes.
There is a show that is, there's a lot about the show that is going to be familiar to folks.
Yes.
Not just the content, but also some of the folks that are going to be in the show. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is a really special story. So we're getting ready to do Fiddler on the Roof. I have to say, it's very special to me. My husband and I met. So that's one of those things, is that we met at a community theater in Michigan. And the first thing we ever said to each other was at an audition, and it was for Fiddler on the Roof. And anyway, I love the story. So we asked a question at an artistic committee meeting over a year ago, where we said, you know, authentic representation of any story that has to do with a specific race is extremely important. And Fiddler on the Roof is maybe the quintessential community theater show because the community is a character. And so can we do this if we don't have a Tevye that is Jewish representing? We're just asking the question. And our director of the show, Dr. Michael O'Hara from Ball State, said, wait a minute, I have an idea. And he contacted a former student named Adam B. Shapiro, who was in the Yiddish theater production off Broadway, playing the rabbi and understudying the role of Tevye. And he's done other things. He plays the rabbi on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which just wrapped up. So we invited him with a contract. So this is something special. So even that, you know, we do, all of our actors are community members. We make an exception in this case. And he arrives April 1st. He'll come in and be memorized. And we're sending him videos of all the choreography and the blocking that we're doing. Blocking means stage directions. We have his measurements. We're building his costume right now. But this is a very special opportunity that allows us to be more authentic than we might be able to be. So we're happy about that. And it gives our actors just something really special, you know, to perform with, and something for our audiences as well. So we're very excited about Adam's arrival. And the show opens April 12th, and we run through April 28th. Everything is on our website, and we have a wonderful youth program as well, opportunities for kids, summer camps, and the auditions for Mary Poppins are coming up in March, and it's all on the website, MuncieCivic.org, or call 288-PLAY.
288-PLAY.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Laura Williamson, thank you for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate you being here, and let the show go on.
It must.
That was IPR's Phil Hoffman talking to Laura Williamson, Artistic and Executive Director at Muncie Civic Theater. Let's find out what another local artist is working on.
Hi, my name is Ron Richcreek. I'm from the Muncie area, and I enjoy the arts. I enjoy creating, and I've started back in the 70s as a Ball State student and art major, and due to circumstances, I've just evolved into different mediums. I enjoyed my black and white photography. I was a portrait photographer for a number of years, and the amount of time that it would take to do one archival print, it's not cost effective, and just like any art, no one is willing to pay for your time. That's one of the drawbacks, and obviously everything's gone to digital, and the black and white and color printing is going to the wayside. But I understand I went and bought some new film, and Roberts in Indianapolis said, he's getting a lot of customers in. Their camera store is fantastic.
Can you tell us what an archival print is?
An archival print is on fiber-based paper, basically black and white photograph. You're oxidizing silver, the silver nitrate on the paper. And archival prints are what museums use, and it won't fade due to sunlight. You've seen a lot of old Civil War photographs, that are still very, very sharp and, distinct. Whereas my senior picture is one of the first color ones that were given to us by People Studios in Muncie that, my gosh, I mean, I have really faded.
So you have this skill that I think you should revive it. You said you just got some film?
Yeah, I've got black and white film. I will develop it myself, but I really lack a dark room. That's Ansel Adams said, that's where the orchestra is in the dark room. My oldest brother used to be an instructor at John Heron in Indianapolis. When he moved from 16th Street to the IUPUI campus, he took his dark room with him. I'm kind of, oh my goodness, I don't have a dark room anymore. But I've been known to develop film in a bathroom before. If you have just total darkness, you could do it.
Well, I'm super glad that there are people who are still doing this the way it used to be.
Yes.
You're like a wheelwright or a iron worker. I don't know. It's really cool.
It's a dying art, and mm-hmm. In that medium, my mentors were Edward Steichen, Albert Stiglitz, Paul Strand. Those are the people that you study, and those are the people that I really enjoyed watching. If you really wanted to see a really good photography magazine, you'd pick up Vogue or Harper's Bazaar and think that's where the photographers were. And besides the fashion photography, they would also do portraiture. They're the ones that set precedent.
You're absolutely right. I was wondering if what are you working on right now?
Well, photography, I'm just kind of playing around with it, but mm-hmm. I just unloaded the bisque kiln I fired last night with some smaller things, little button jars. And my style is based after the aesthetics in pottery was established by the Koreans, Japanese, and the Chinese. They're the ones that made the kilns, and they're the ones that developed the glazes, and they're the ones that developed the porcelain, thing of that nature. And, you do the history just like anything else.
Well, can you describe some of your pottery to us, what it might look like?
My pottery, I still, it goes back to drawing or photography. It's line and form. That's what influences me the most. Mm-hmm. To get a good line on the outside of a pot. A lot of people, do a lot of decoratives and stuff. My main objective is to make a piece that has a beautiful shape to it. Korean moon jars are just gorgeous. They're just a small lipped sphere with a small foot. And the Koreans said the small foot, or the bottom piece on the bottom, would extend just a little bit and give the appearance of that piece floating.
Ooh.
And, you know, that's the culture of finding beauty.
Yeah. Like
beauty in nature.
When you say you and the line informs your work, drawing a line in concert with the shape, can you talk about that a little more?
Well, like in figure drawing, you know, your contour, the contour of that body, whether it be a body or a piece of clay, you know, a sculpture. That's what I'm seeking.
Nice. I just wanted to know, is there, when you're talking about nature and a lot of inspiration that you get, do you get inspiration? How do you get into a creative mindset?
Well, it depends on the medium. You know, there's days where I don't throw because just not into it, you know, but days, you know, where I'll get out, you know, and I'll see something. I got up in the middle of the night and wrote down something that I was thinking about, you know, obviously in my sleep, but I got up, wrote it down. And I thought of a falling petal from a flower, just a single petal falling from a flower. And you have a stem, and, you know, that's going to be a theme in one of my next pieces. You know, I don't know whether it's subconscious or what, you know, but it's just something, wow, I think I'll use that.
You know? That's beautiful. Do you know what it's going to, how you're going to translate that?
Yeah, yes, I do. And it was kind of a happy mistake out at John Peterson's place where we were putting white over a type of green glaze. It's called a stripe green. It's kind of a lighter green. And the copper in the A-stripe green turned the white glaze into a lavender.
Ooh.
You know, you'd have to see it to appreciate it. But a lot of times things, you know, by mistakes are just as valuable as planned. I, you know, to sit down and, you know, to copy, like being a photographer for over 50 years, our daughter, who was an art major at Ball State, says, "Dad, you're too anal. Loosen up." You know, and when I draw now, I'm a lot more free in my line. Whereas with a photograph, you know, you're very exact.
Yeah,
you have to loosen up a little bit. And the same thing with the pottery. You know, you have an idea in your head, and that's what you strive for, but it doesn't happen all the time.
It's true. I wanted to know, like, does it help you to move between the medium that you work on? Like,
I do. I do. I enjoy drawing. I haven't so much with the photographs or the photography lately. I'm more of a figurative person. With the photography, I was more of a portraiture. And Steichen, Irving Penn, all those old guys, they would find people's faces with character.
Mm-hmm.
You take a good black and white photograph, you know, and you know, just the person's face will tell a story. Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, all the photographers during the FSA, the Farm Security Administration, back during the Depression era, would go out and hunt down people of strife. You know, FDR wanted to document the plight of America. And so he set these photographers out in the Dust Bowl, and they were published in Life magazine. And due to those photographs, it changed public opinion in regards to our social status in the United States. Art in general can change. Obviously, you know that. I mean, it can change people's attitudes. And people, the majority of the people just don't understand that. You know, they just think it's just putting oil paint on a canvas, you know. But people, you know, you look around, everything that man has made has been put on a piece of paper with a pencil, a pen, whatever. You know, you have to have a foundation that you build from that, you know, and art is, in my opinion, is to create an emotion, whether it be positive or negative. That emotion can change the world.
I heartily agree with that, Ron. I want to thank you so much for talking to us, Ron.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're listening to Pop of Culture. A few places and events we're excited about this week include the Loblolly Nature Preserve in Jay County. As we get closer to spring in Indiana, this dedicated nature preserve has approximately 3.5 miles of easy walking trails and a quarter mile ADA accessible trail with benches. The preserve is open to the public from dawn to dusk and features a tree identification trail. If you forgot to do something for your Valentine, or if you need a little extra love for yourself, the Richmond Symphony Orchestra is performing a concert they're calling Love and Fate. It's this Sunday, February 25th at 3 p.m. Tickets can be found at richmondsymphony.org or by calling their box office at 765-966-5181. Did you know that there's a refuge for freedom seekers in Wayne County? This 8-room home served as a safe haven for more than 1,000 freedom seekers on their journey to Canada. Levi and Catherine Kaufman's home became known as the Grand Central Station of the Underground Railroad. Tickets are available at indianamuseum.org. The eclipse is coming, and we are in the path of totality. What will you be doing? One event is Meg's Country Celebrations Eclipse Experience on Saturday, April 6th, Sunday, April 7th, and Monday, April 8th, the big day. Embellish your eclipse glasses, listen to live music, make jewelry, and more. Go to Meg's Country Celebrations on Facebook. Have an event we should hear about for Pop of Culture? Talk to us at indianapublicradio.org/popofculture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, the IAC's Arts Partner for East Central Indiana, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency, and by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
Well, that's our show. Pop of Culture is produced by Luke Jones. It was hosted this week by me, Kara Duquette, with special thanks to Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of Indiana Public Radio. We're online at indianapublicradio.org and in the real world at Ball State University.